and welcome to Unjustly Maligned, the show for people who go against the grain. We seek to rehabilitate the overlooked, ignored, derided, or the just plain hated. Movies, novels, music, comic books, video games, whatever. If everyone hates it, or even just doesn't know it exists, we'll find someone who loves it and let them explain why you should too. I'm your host, Anthony Johnston, and my guest today is Kent Massey. Kent, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Now, it's fair to say that we do occasionally stretch the remit of this show, and this is one of those times, but this subject is just so fascinating that I, when you, you know, offered to come on the show and talk about it, I just couldn't resist. So regular listeners will note that I did not give Kent an epithet just then, as I normally do with guests, and that is because, frankly, it's kind of hard to sum up in a word or two. So, Kent, why don't you please tell us what you've come on the show to talk about, but also at the same time explain why you're qualified to talk about it and what motivated you to want to come on and tell us all about it today.
Sure. Well, as I joke at cocktail parties when people ask me what I do for a living, I say I build robots that kill people. And that's sort of true, actually. I for the last 15 years or so, have worked in military ground robotics. Mostly the robots that go after roadside bombs and, you know, save people. But, you know, it's the military and they want to weaponize things. And so, you know, it inevitably leads to this, you know, specter of killer robots that are out to exterminate humanity. And I'm here to speak on their behalf because they can't. And
it's got to be a hell of an icebreaker at parties, that, hasn't it?
Well, mostly people just sort of laugh nervously and, you know, but...
And change the subject.
Yeah. Around geeks, I think people tend to be interested. It is a fascinating subject. It's one that I think all of us feel like we have some sense of it, but most people, the reality is so very, very different from the popular perception. I really wanted to look forward to coming on to this to tell you about that because, as I've said, whenever I talk to the press in my job, you know, the first question is, why are you building these killer robots that are out to destroy humanity? And it's very hard to get anything other than that sensationalistic sort of impression off the table.
Right. Yeah. I mean, this is, yeah, as people have obviously guessed by now, this is another of our sort of non-fiction episodes.
Yes.
But as you said, but fiction does link into this because, as you say, there is a popular perception that is largely a result of science fiction, you know, of movies, books, TV shows, whatever, of this sort of futuristic, dystopian, nightmarish vision of things like Terminator. That technology will run out of control. And that if we don't stop what we're doing now, we're going to create self-thinking, autonomous machines that will rise up and kill us. You know, the rise of the machines is a well-worn sci-fi trope by now. There are many people who genuinely fear that, not necessarily Terminator itself, but that, you know, autonomous, self-guiding, autonomously targeting weapons will be a genuine threat to humanity. There are people at the UN working to sort of try and regulate them even while technology is running away from them. So it is something that's a genuine worry for a lot of people. But yeah, your angle, and this is what really interested me about it, obviously because you're so involved in the field, is that's simply, because a lot of people say, oh, it's like, it's only 10 years away. But you're saying that it's more like 100 years away if it will ever happen at all.
Well, so anytime you put a weapon on something, it's dangerous. And I think there are very real dangers, but I think the dangers that exist are quite different than the popular perception. I mean, I'm a nerd. I love science fiction. I loved the movie Terminator. But it's a story. I think we understand the world in terms of stories. And in terms of personal relationships with other people. So when we confront something that's inanimate, I think there's a natural tendency within people to turn it into animate and to tell a story about it, to make it a thing that they can relate to on a personal basis. So, you know, these implacable forces of nature, when we were, hunter-gatherers, we turned into gods. Even now we tend to name things, we name ships, we name, you know, we have this relationship that we feel. And then there's this weird place where when something is inanimate, but animate, when it's a chimera, when, you know, it's like that, snake that's camouflaged and looks like a stone or a stick until it moves, and it's terrifying.
Mm.
Everything that's hardwired into us tells us this is wrong, this is dangerous. And I think James Cameron with Terminator hit the perfect trifecta. I mean, it's this, you know, inanimate thing clothed in a human form that is, you know, almost there and terrifyingly evil and scary. And that's such a powerful trope. And you're right. I mean, it exists through the last 20 years of science fiction. But what happens is because, so, I mean, what Cameron basically did was kind of ignored the real science of what's possible. And that's, you know, what writers do. It makes things fun. And then he posed the existential threat that this thing is out to kill and enslave humanity. And then he said, you know, the power figures around those idiot managers at Skynet, you know, they're working hard to bring about the end. You know, why are they so stupid? This is, that process is ages old. It's how, you know, snake oil salesmen used to sell miracle cures.
Mm-hmm.
It's how politicians pass off alternative facts. It's all about saying, you know, the normal rules don't quite apply in this. They're really wrong. There's this existential threat you've got to worry about. And the authority figures, you know, they're stupid. They're colluding. They're, listen to me. I have, you know, the reality that you need to pay attention to. And people, you know, faced with that existential threat, people really buy into it. They buy into it hard. It's, you know, when someone believes in that alternative fact, you know, you can't dissuade them. I just, it's so frustrating for me on the other side of, you know, the people are just convinced that, you know, these weaponized remote systems are inevitably going to kill humanity. Like, they're dangerous, but they're, you know, that's giving them way too much credit, guys.
Right, you're saying that if that happens, it'll be because of humans, not because the machines suddenly become autonomous and, you know, sentient and decide to kill us of their own accord.
Yes, right. So, you know, AI, robots are a kind of a special case of AI in the sense that it's about applying perception and autonomy to moving in the real world. And if we stop and think about it, AI is actually really limited and kind of stupid. It works incredibly well within fairly narrow boundaries. So, like, everyone's all hopped up on self-driving cars. I mean, I have dealt with autonomy and, you know, for the last 15 years. I'm here to tell you that we're not going to have fully self-driving cars going down the street anytime real soon. Now, everyone says, but they're out there. Well, they're primarily operating on highways, limited access highways. And so at high speed, when we as people are driving, in order to be safe, we have to restrict the parameters. We have to keep, we have to simplify, dumb down the situation. So there's on-ramps and off-ramps. You don't have cross traffic. The roads are really well marked, and the grades are simple, and the curves are smooth. That's the kind of problem that AI can wail on. That's the sort of thing that AI can do incredibly well. But once you get off the road and you're into construction site, or you've got potholes, or you've got a kid dashing out, it becomes much, much harder for AI. So just the simple stuff like, us engineers worry about. If you're driving and you go through a cloud of bugs, splat, 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 you can move your head around inside the car and see through the windshield, and you can put on the windshield wipers. And even though you have degraded vision, you can maybe pull off the side of the road if you need to clean it off. If you are relying on a few sensors to navigate this car, and you're sitting there with your seat back and you're reading or doing something else, splat, 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 those sensors are now covered with goo and can't see a thing. You went from pure self-driving car to total meltdown in the AI system in a fraction of a second. And now the car is relying on you to take over and, fix things. It takes a typical person 2 or 3 seconds to gain the situational awareness and do that. A lot can happen in a 2-ton car in 3 or 4 seconds.
Especially when you're traveling at 60 miles an hour, yeah.
Yes, yeah. But even on a side street, things can go wrong pretty fast. So the folks, there's an amazing amount of money going into doing self-driving. But when you get into unrestricted domains, into the messiness, it's really hard. Like if you're in a crowded restaurant, and it's noisy, and your cell phone goes off, and you answer it and sort of say, hey, hang on a second, let me kind of get out of here. You can be navigating your way through these tables, through all these people, through a waiter passing by, as you're still trying to sort of talk to the person on the phone, saying, just give me another second. And you're doing things like you're making eye contact with a waiter without even being consciously aware of it, passing signals back and forth about who has precedence, who's going to pass who. You can weave your way out of that crowded restaurant in 20 seconds. For a robot to try to do that is an impossible task. On the military side, we can't get robots to tell a small bush apart from a rock. I mean, they're both sort of round-shaped. Yeah, no, it's a really hard thing to do. If it's green, maybe it's a bush, except if it's a rock, maybe it has lichen on it. And there's a big difference between running over a bush and running over a rock.
Right.
But, a fifth grader, five-year-old in a kindergarten classroom, they can wind their way through these crowded tables and people running this way and that way and not hit other people, not fall over. We have those kinds of skills. That we've built up that are deep into our visual cortex and our proprioceptive system. We know how to navigate the world. Teaching a robot to do that is insanely hard. and even in my job where, I've got to constantly tell the folks in the military, yeah, all that stuff you see in the sci-fi movies, we can't really do that.
I'm sure that does come up, yeah. Let's rewind a little and tell us, how did you get into this line of work? What attracted you specifically? Because obviously you're an engineer, so what attracted you specifically to working on military applications for robots?
Oh, gosh. I had sold a business and was a little bit at loose ends, and was at a MIT alumni meeting and ran into an older alum who said, hey, there's this cool thing I did for DARPA back, 20 years ago. And he sort of pulled out of his basement and said, do you think, you're interested in trying to make a go of this? And it was a head aim vision system. And I said, hey, sure, I'm not doing anything, And the application for that turned out to be initially the robots that go after roadside bombs. And that was a very rewarding thing to work on. I mean, back in the mid-2000s when, as engineers, you're used to getting no respect, but we'd, get these letters or emails from the soldiers who's, sent us pictures of their blown up robots saying, thank you. That could have been me. That would have been me. That's, know that you've done something that has made a difference. that's saved somebody's life is a big deal. So, it's a fascinating, difficult project to take on to try to be moving something remotely through this environment, navigating and manipulating things in the environment. It's just a really fascinating challenge.
And one that's constantly changing, I imagine. It's it's never completed. It can never be completed, I imagine.
Yes, correct. And so in the military, being in the military, they want to do more and more with it. So, I started working on a project about 6 years ago that's for about a half ton robot that its primary mission is to carry supplies for infantry. But of course, they also want to see, what does it mean to put a weapon on this thing? How do we control that? That's only a minor part of the project right now, but it's an important to understand what those issues are. And the U.S. military is very, very cautious about moving down this path. In large part because of all the fears about Terminator and those kinds of things. They don't want to rush forward.
Right. You mentioned how attached soldiers become to things like, anti-IED robots and stuff. And you also earlier mentioned the sort of tendency for humans to anthropomorphize objects that, either look or behave human. And I remember most people, I imagine, listening to this will have seen the videos of Big Dog.
Yes.
The robotics project. Is that MIT, I think?
Well, it was a spin-out from MIT, yeah. Mark Ray was a professor there and then went to found Boston Dynamics that has done some really wonderful work, yeah.
Oh, Boston Dynamics, yes. So most people will have seen Big Dog and will have seen the quite amazing, actually, progression that they've made with it over, it doesn't even feel like 10 years, maybe it is, but it certainly feels like a very short space of time. They've gone from quite a sort of, lumbering, huge machine to the latest ones are really quite agile and capable. But the thing that I will always remember about those videos myself is in the first couple of videos, sort of compilations of tests, there were two incidents that I remember. There was one where somebody was testing its stability and they kicked it. It was walking along, sort of with all that hanging down from the wires and stuff and the sensors, and somebody kicked it from the side and you see the Big Dog obviously stumble, but then, right itself. And there's another one where you see it trying to walk across a frozen area and it does a bit of a Bambi, but again, rights itself eventually. It does succeed, which is amazing. But more than that, I remember my own really visceral reaction to that. Now, I'm a dog lover, which may have made a difference. I don't know. But when I saw the engineer kick the Big Dog and its reaction to it, which I know, intellectually, I know is a purely robotic, gyroscope-driven reaction, but I was horrified. I was like, oh my God, no, don't kick it. Don't be cruel. And when it was slipping on the ice, the same thing. I was like, oh, please don't fall over. And I know intellectually it's a machine, but because it moves so realistically, as it were, so naturally to what we're used to seeing with quadruped animals. It just gets you right in the sort of, I don't know, there's some kind of instinct, for me anyway, some kind of instinctive reaction. And what's, I mean, that in itself is fascinating, but equally fascinating for me is that I don't have anything like the same reaction for the little, I can't remember what they're called, the little robots that Honda and Sony and that lot make.
Yeah, no, they're, yeah. They're...
Because they don't move like humans. They move like toy robots, whereas Big Dog looks nothing at all like an organic being, but it moves so sort of naturalistically that it brings out this reaction.
That was Mark Rabbit's wonderful breakthrough was when we walk, it's actually an unstable dynamic movement. We're essentially falling forward and catching ourselves. Mm. Asimo, the Japanese robotics walk in a stable fashion. More like, and I think it's almost kind of cultural. They see robots as being sort of servants, or, you know, it's like a woman walking in a kimono. They take little steps and statically stable.
Right. Whereas, so you're saying that the Asimo, I remember it's right, Asimo, yes, I couldn't remember the name. Asimo could stop at any point during its locomotion and it wouldn't fall over.
Correct. Whereas what, you know, us being, you know, big, brash, you know, arrogant Americans, we, you know, Boston Dynamics created this thing that really captured that dynamicism of constantly falling forward and catching itself. And yes, it looks amazingly lifelike. Now, I'm a soulless engineer, so when I watch those things, I'm just amazed at the, you know, how the proprioceptive system on the robot and how the actuators are moving quickly enough to catch itself. I don't feel badly when I see the person kick it, but I understand that people do. What amazes me, frankly, though, is, you know, the soldiers who use these systems, who really know better, you know that they're machines, form deep attachments to them. There was a wonderful story of earlier on in the Iraq conflict, we stood up a repair center in Baghdad, and the EOD soldiers would bring in the broken robots and fix them. And one soldier came in, it was a blown up pile of junk, and very upset, wanted, you know, to have it fixed. And the repair tech said, I can do better than that. I can give you a brand new robot. And the soldier said, but that's Scooby, you know, can you fix him? You know, Scooby had saved his life again and again and again.
He didn't want a brand new robot. He wanted his robot back.
And the tech had been there long enough. He knew what was going on. And he said, okay. And he took the pile of parts back, scavenged off of it what he could that was, you know, still viable, replaced brand new parts on a brand new robot with these beat up old parts, and brought it back. And, you know, okay, the spirit of Scooby is in this box.
Wow.
And it was incredibly important for that soldier. I remember working with some of the senior EOD sergeants, master sergeant at Picatinny Arsenal, where we're developing the new technology for these things. And he was talking to a group of West Point cadets, and there was a two-star general there, and he was talking about, you know, his early experiences in Iraq, where he had lost six robots during his tour. And he talked about it like an old cavalry soldier would talk about having horses shot out from underneath him. There was almost a tear in his eye in the sense of, you know, these brave machines who had, you know, saved him from certain death by taking the hit. You know, and these soldiers work with them. They understand the limitations and that they are mechanical, and yet they are so real to them. They're much more real than any other mechanism they use. And when they take unit photos of all the guys in the unit. If they've got robots, the robots are posed with the other guys in the unit. They feel that way about them, which always kind of amazes me.
Wow, so they treat them like they are another soldier in the unit. To an extent.
Yes, they have that feeling. They have that connection. I mean, they know that they have limitations, the robots do. But yeah, it's more than a machine for them.
Right. Oh, yeah. So more like, say, if they were a platoon that had sniffer dogs or something.
Yes, it's very much like that. Yeah, any platoon that's got a canine will have the dog in the photo as well.
Right.
Yep.
Okay, that really is. I mean, it's understandable, of course. You know, as we understand, as I say, because I think we get that reaction ourselves to certain things. But it's also fascinating that even, as you say, sort of battle-hardened soldiers who use this technology, and they know it's technology, and they understand that it's just a collection of wires and circuits and armor plating and what have you, but they still form these attachments to it.
Yes, and they're really quite powerful.
Forming those attachments also means, this is something that you and I discussed briefly before the show over email, was that it also means that people ascribe motives to things. When they anthropomorphize them, there's a tendency to also therefore assume that, well, if they're, you know, if they're like beings, if they're like animals or like people, that means they must also have their own motivations. And that starts us down the road of then people starting to think about evil robots.
Sure. So, you know, obviously the robot is the other, and, you know, if it somehow or other magically is as autonomous and smart as a person, then, you know, it's going to want to protect its own and, you know, enslave or destroy humanity. And, you know, you kind of step back and think about it, you know, from the soulless engineer point of view and go, what the heck? You know, no. but like I said, I think we as people understand the world through stories and through personal relationships. I see that in how the soldiers create that personal relationship with, you know, with an inanimate object, but for them it's real. I understand the power of that story that so many people tell themselves when they see, you know, these autonomous machines. And in truth, right now, they are mostly remotely controlled devices. They are butt stupid.
Right. You know,
and if you think in truth about the level of autonomy, I mean, we all sort of laugh at the, and if anyone's seen the DARPA robotics challenges and these robots sort of falling over, they can't open up a door. And yet, you know, we somehow rather can see that and laugh at it and understand how limited, you know, that kind of capability is. And at the same time, tell us ourselves these stories about, you know, these Terminator sort of killer machines that, you know, have human-like reasoning, which is just, you know, that's not even remotely on the horizon.
Right. Okay, well, let me play devil's advocate for a moment, because
sure.
I understand, obviously, your point about, you know, how primitive AI is compared to the reality of, you know, what's required for sentient thought. But I can think of two counters, if you like, to that. I mean, first, there's the conspiracy theory that, you know, people listening might say, well, of course he'll say that because it's all a big secret and this is propaganda. and there's, you know, there's no way for any of us to disprove that, so we've just got to take your word for it. But the second counter that I can think of is the multiplication effect. Because let's say, for example, let's take computers themselves. Computers literally did not exist until, you know, sort of what, you know, about a third of the way through the 20th century, maybe more than that. And now, much less than 100 years later, we have iPhones and Alexas and Google Search and, you know, God knows what else. And they are so much further advanced than anything those people in 1940 or whenever could possibly have imagined. So who is to say that there couldn't be some kind of similar breakthrough in this area in, say, I don't know, a decade's time, that wouldn't then have the same acceleration effect, you know, that really accelerate the rate of further breakthroughs that could build upon that to the point where what seemed like it might take 200 years suddenly actually only takes 50 years.
Sure. So and all that is very real. The thing that I think has to be teased apart is this desperate need on behalf of people to anthropomorphize things. So when we talk about AI, I mean, we've, you know, for the last 50 years, AI has been around the corner, because we thought AI was going to be this thing we could talk to. You know, have you tried talking to Siri? I mean, or Alexa, or yeah. You know, yeah. yet, astonishing leap forward, and AI is very, very real now. I mean, Google search is essentially this insanely smart AI, but it's not a person. It's not anthropomorphic. It does complex tasks within a discrete domain incredibly well. So I think that is going to continue to move forward. That's completely different than this human-like intelligence that we'll interact with. That one is, I'm pretty certain, you know, centuries away. I think AI is going to get much, much more competent. And I think, you know, the real threat of robots is not in the military side. It's what it's going to do to our middle class in terms of displacing jobs. That's going to be very difficult to deal with.
Well, and that is something that is already happening, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. I've been worried about this for a long time, and I looked back, Rome, when it was still democracy, it went through the Punic Wars, and the tradition of the Roman farmer, citizen, soldier was the backbone, the strength of Rome, and allowed it to destroy Carthage. I mean, literally plow salt into their fields. But at the end of the Punic Wars, they had an immense number of captives that were slaves. They brought them back to Rome to become this rich society, you know, financially rich. The wealthy people in Rome bought up the slaves, bought the land from these small citizen farmers, and created large estates that were farmed by slave labor. And the citizen farmers went into the city, blew their money, and became poor, became the mob that had to be entertained with bread and circuses. And that was, you know, Rome lasted a long time beyond that, but that was the beginning of the end. That was when they lost the strength of that citizen farmer soldier. The same thing happened in England in the sort of the end of the Dark Ages, beginning of the Renaissance. There was a revolution in kind of farming technology, slow, but the enclosure laws were passed. It used to be that, you know, the yeoman farmer, also the soldier, the backbone of the English society, the one in Agincourt. They were displaced as the enclosure laws happened. They were sort of thrown off the land, and these large landholders came into being. Farming technology shifted over the years. They wound up this you know, poor mass of people in the cities, in the poorhouses, in the workhouses, on the dole. I mean, England really struggle to deal with. I mean, this is the, you know, what time of Dickens. And what happened was the Industrial Revolution came along to sort of save, well, besides, you know, exporting them to America and Australia, but
yeah, we did do a fair amount of that too.
Yes. But, you know, these enormous dislocations of technology or in the case of the Romans, you know, slave labor, displacing the middle class and destroying the middle class, that working class, middle class, it's happened before, and it takes a long time to correct. You need that new thing, like the Industrial Revolution, to come along that creates employment. The United States, we're still make more stuff than China. We make more stuff than any other country. Our manufacturing capability over the last 20 or 30 years has doubled, but we do it with half the people.
Right.
Our productivity is more than quadrupled, and that's going to keep on going. So, alternative facts can say we're going to bring jobs back, but the reality is that the march of automation, robots, and technology is going to continue to displace jobs. I think, when I look at the things to be worried about in robotics, that's what scares me is, how do we handle this? And I think, like I said, weaponized robots are, it's got a weapon, and you have to be careful with it. It's scary. The things, though, that I worry about there are, so for the United States, we're really careful about rules of engagement, and there's always going to be a human in the loop. You're not going to have something going fully autonomous mode. There's no, let's feed photos of bad guys into the robot, have them go out and find them and kill them. That's just, that's not going to be how we wage war going forward. But what I think you could see happen, if the rules of engagement allow the declaration of what's called a free fire zone. So the unit commander, if he has the permission, can say, you know what, there's nothing out in front of us but bad guys. And anything that moves, you can shoot it and kill it. So it's a formal process of declaring, this is, that's a free fire zone over there. We're attacking. A semi-autonomous weapon platform in that mode, it will shoot anything, that moves. I could see other countries that maybe don't worry as much about the niceties and rules of engagement creating systems like that. In essence, they're mobile landmine fields. And, the UN, banned landmines for a pretty good reason. They kill indiscriminately. And I think, any remote weaponized platform that had that set of instructions that said, if it moves, shoot it, that's not a good idea. That's something that needs to be tightly constrained. But at the same time, it's not really different from having a couple guys with a machine gun out there who have orders to shoot anything they see. And in opposition, if you're an army attacking it, nowadays you can detect where fire is coming from within seconds. You can slew a weapon to it and fire on it. You can kill that thing really quickly. So it's not as though it's this horrific destroying machine. It's just another weapon system that you have to understand how to use, understand the limitations of, and understand what the counters are. And like any, weapon, these things can be abused, but it's not this autonomous, I'm going to go out and kill humanity thing.
Right. I mean, that abuse is, that's a genuine concern. I know that's something that, again, the UN and their Council on Conventional Weapons is something that they're discussing and are, several people are kind of worried about. And the US notably has so far refused to endorse a ban on autonomous weapon systems. But I do wonder how much of that is because, as you say, if there are plenty of other people out there who may not follow the rules of engagement quite so closely, and they are going to have this technology as well. And so the concern, I think, with a lot of people is, okay, well, we're the good guys. We're not going to send we're not going to, as you said, like feed photos of terrorists into a drone and then send it into a populated city to try and find them. But that doesn't mean that the bad guys might not do that and tell them to fire on anything wearing like a US soldier's helmet.
Sure. But I think it's actually more basic. I think a lot of the folks who are agitating against sort of killer robots, whether it's at the UN or other forums, have conflated autonomy, unrealistic autonomy, with the weaponized system. And they have at some core fundamental level this notion of these, you know, Terminator-like killing machines. The problem is there are real issues that need to be addressed, but I think the sensationalization of the autonomous killing machine has made it almost impossible to actually come to grips with what the real issues are and how to deal with them, how to create international law that deals with it. And I think the United States has always, well, for the last 50 years, we've used technology to increase our combat capability. And so we're really reluctant to, you know, write off something that could further increase that combat capability.
Well, and that's totally understandable, because I mean, there's a lot of talk these days about how, you know, cyber war is the next, you know, big thing. And I think I don't think anybody would really argue against that. And so you have to, I think, take the attitude of like, well, if that's coming down the line, then technology of all kinds, whether it's online, you know, attack stuff, or whether it is the use of technology in conventional warfare, these are the things that are going to bring increase effectiveness to any, you know, army. And everybody, technology is one of those things, it's like Pandora's box, isn't it? Once it's open, once it's out there, you can't put it back in the box. I mean, that's why there's so much controversy over human cloning. I can totally understand, like I say, why the US hasn't signed up to these bans. But, you know, at the same time, there's a certain amount of public perception going on around that. And that's something I wanted to touch on, actually, because you are a founder of the Robotics Technology Consortium, and you also served on the US Department of Defense Technical Advisory Board for robotics. So, I mean, so you obviously know a lot of other engineers in this field, not just the ones that your colleagues that you work alongside, but, you know, from other organizations and institutions as well. And
sure.
I assume that this is a prevalent concern amongst all of them. And what I mean by that is the concern of how to get across to non-engineers that they shouldn't conflate fantasy ideas of autonomy with what's realistically available to, you know, to soldiers and armies at this point in time.
I think most of us we throw up our hands just because we're engineers. We mostly don't talk well to other people. We just, you know, like, okay, I'm just going to go solve my technical problem and not worry about your little fantasy. Folks who do try to, you know, come to terms with this and wrestle with the issues. It is frustrating for me, like I said, when I'm at some event and the press shows up, and, you know, the first, last, and all the intermediate questions are all about killer robots. And, like, you know, it's almost impossible. You know, they want the 20-second soundbite. They want the conflict. They want the sensational. And they don't want to really understand the boring ins and outs of, you know, yeah, it's not the thing you think it is. There's issues here that need to be dealt with, but it's not out to destroy humanity.
Right. But as you say, in the modern soundbite press culture, that's not what they want to hear, is it? They either want to hear, yes, it's going to happen, and it'll be terrible, or no, it's not possible at all, don't worry, you silly little heads.
Yes.
And, well, neither of those things is true.
Right. And frankly, some of what angers me is some of the, not necessarily the engineers, some of the managers in some of the other companies or research groups dealing with robotics, will tend to try to sell some of the sensationalized stuff to, you know, the generals and, you know, to get them to fund things. And
right.
We can't do this. We can't deliver it. We're going to consistently disappoint and oversell if we start spreading the hype. It's not doing anyone any favors. I mean, we need to be clear about what the good and the bad is.
I imagine that most of the people who listen to the show are fairly technically literate, and I would imagine anyone who has any experience of dealing with technology and clients and managers, that's a fairly common, you know,
yes.
Overpromising for the sake of making a sale is a fairly common issue.
Yes. Yeah, the salesperson goes back, look what I sold.
Yep. And you're like, we can't build that.
Yeah. Or as we used to joke years ago, you know, we'd have some scary robot marching across the battlefield and the enemy would go, oh no. And then someone would say, but wait, it's running Windows.
Oh, goodness. That brings a whole new meaning to blue screen of death.
Yes. It'll crash.
Oh,
yeah. You know, because we deal with the in and out everyday frustration of just getting these things to go up a hill. You know, it's...
Right. Or as you said, recognize the difference between a rock and a bush. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
Oh, all right, so in closing, then let's wind this up. In closing, what is it? What sort of takeaway do you want people to get from this?
Oh gosh, to really parse out the difference between the wonderful science fiction and storytelling that's out there, and appreciate it for what it is, but know that it's not reality. And there are things to be worried about within the reality, but they're different. They're not the end of humanity. They're you know, not insignificant, but it to really understand that, you know, you can't anthropomorphize these things and give them agency that they don't have. Yeah, I think that's the real takeaway, is to appreciate the stories for what they are, but know that, you know, the reality is very, very different.
All right. This has been absolutely fascinating. Kent, thank you so much for coming on the show and talking to us about this.
Well, thank you. I appreciate the chance to do it.
Thanks for listening to Unjustly Maligned. You can check out my other work, including comics, books, music, and more, at anthonyjohnston.com, where you'll find more information about all of my work. You can support Unjustly Maligned by becoming a member of the Incomparable Network. Go to theincomparable.com/members to sign up and check the box for Unjustly Maligned when you choose which shows to support. You can also help by reviewing Unjustly Maligned on iTunes and following us on Twitter at UMPFM. Finally, the show notes for this episode are at ump.fm. Unjustly Maligned is a 7RQ production for The Incomparable and is made in England. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.
So like the program I'm working on now, I mean, there was a period about 6 years ago where I had 2 weeks that that's kind of, you know, it wasn't really doing much. You know, I'm now working for a company, so I'm getting paid. I'm thinking, well, I ought to do something. So I fired up my CAD program and started creating the design for this robot, this half-ton robot that I really thought the military was going to need at some point. And it eventually turned, or is in the process of turning, into what they call a program of record, where, you know, after 6 years and a dozen different field exercises and probably $10 million of R&D, they're creating the requirements so that on an accelerated basis in 2 years' time, They will put out the request for proposal, which we'll have to compete on and could very well lose. But if we win it, you know, the first machines coming out the other end will be another 2 years. I mean, this is a 10-year time span.
Wow.
To get one system to initial fielding. And that's accelerated. So yes,
right, so that's considered fast tracking.
Yes. Yes.
Wow. Good God.
So, you know, I sometimes run into like high school students who are all starry-eyed about robots, and I'm thinking, oh my goodness.
Right. By the time anything like that comes around, you guys will be middle-aged.
Yes. Well, they want to get into the field and they think it's just fascinating. They want to become, you know, work as a roboticist. And first off, there's not many jobs in this field. And secondly, you know, you just have, I mean, years ago, daughter was, 18, I recruited her. We were doing a user interface study for how to, control a remote, system. And she spent all day. I mean, she was awesome. Got great data from it. We had, because we're looking at soldiers. We recruited a dozen sort of 18 to 20 year old kids to use these systems. And I was really grateful. And we were driving back at the end of the day for the field tests. And she said, "Dad, you've been working on this for a couple of years, right?" I said, "Yeah." Because for me, it was an awesome day to see it actually being used and everything else. And she said, and that's all it does? And, oh, that was soul destroying. But the next bit was even better. She said, "You know, if I had to do that for a living, I'd shoot myself." Oh, and this was one of the best days I had at work in you know, over a year. And it was, oh my God.
I sympathize very much with, you know, soldiers who form emotional attachments to machines and stuff. And actually, just in general, people who form emotional attachments to things like that, to tools and things like that, because my comparison would be, I had, for many years, a guitar. That and it was a beat up, even when I bought it, you know, it was a secondhand beaten up guitar. It wasn't like a big name brand, it was like a Yamaha. But that guitar was with me for a decade or thereabouts, and I battered the hell out of it. It went everywhere with me. I used it all the time. It never once let me down. And you know, and I still get emotional. I don't have it anymore. And I still get emotional thinking about that guitar. I regret that I don't have it anymore. And that was just a guitar, for heaven's sake. It didn't even do anything that I didn't directly manipulate on it myself. You know, it had no robotics or anything in it at all. But I still formed a very emotional, it was my guitar. Didn't matter that there were thousands more like it out there in the world, or at least when it came off the factory line. You know, this was mine. And it felt right in my hands, and I got used to how it felt in my hands. And so, you know, obviously it's a different situation, but I think there's a similar, I can really understand the sort of, as I say, how people form this emotional attachment to machines that do things for and with them, that they act in concert with.
Yes. And I'm unfortunately somewhat, immune to it.
I think you probably have to be in your job, don't you?
Well, I mean, but not all engineers. I mean, some of our engineers, I mean, one of the first of the systems we made in this new generation, the engineer is called Helen. I think the movie Troy was out, and it was the heartless bitch who destroyed marriages.
Right.
They had to put so many hours into, it was a very accelerated schedule. They were working night and day. It was tough. But after a whole series of tests and evaluations, we took it to Aberdeen for blast testing. And they put an undisclosed amount of C4 explosive underneath it to simulate a improvised explosive device and set it off. And the one that was set off in front of the flail, the system survived, but the one that was set off underneath the tracks, pieces of that thing were raining down for about 30 seconds afterwards. And it was really sad for the engineering group that, Helen had been blown apart. I mean,
in a resentful way, they still, wow.
Yep. Yep. Because, anytime you put your heart and soul into a thing, you make it real. The Velveteen Rabbit, right?
Right.
Yeah. So, it was sobering.
I've got to ask this just because, because of the network we're on, I've got to ask the robot or not question. Like, much of what we call robotics in the modern engineering sense is not autonomous at all. It's kind of blindly programmed, or has very limited, autonomy and sensors. You've referred to these things throughout as robots, things like the anti-IED machines and stuff, but are they really robots, or are they just kind of remote controlled cars?
Yeah, so far they are not truly robots. We're on the cusp of giving them some levels of semi-autonomy. So the driver assist behaviors where you tell the vehicle you think you're driving it, but it's intermediating for your commands to go, yeah, I know he wants to do this, but the terrain is like this and my center of gravity is here, and if I turn that sharply, I'm going to roll over. So I'm going to, turn more carefully.
Interesting area. So it gets your desire, but it carries out that desire in an autonomous fashion.
Right. So that's just the very beginnings, and like the weaponization process, we deal with the real world. There's latency. I know you play video games, right? So yeah. One of the best studies on effective latency on this kind of thing was a guy who ran a Quake 3 arena online, and he could measure ping times of the people playing, how much latency they had, and then the number of frags per minute. And you can, it's just, by the time you get out to a tenth of a second of latency, you're toast. I mean, you're losing, 3-1 in terms of, yeah. And you get out to a quarter second, you might as well just, have target painted on you.
That sounds like me playing Quake full stop.
but in the real world of controlling these things remotely, let alone a satellite hop, quarter second latencies are kind of real. And so the process we're kind of working through now is, okay, I'm scanning, I see something in the target picture remotely, and I tap on it and say, that's the target I want to hit. And that signal goes back out to the robot. The robot basically rewinds its little video memory and says, okay, when he tapped on it, he was pointed at this a quarter second ago.
Right, because it's probably already moved by now.
Right. So, the robot then locks on to it and says, do I have that, completely clear in terms of tracking it over the past time, and has anything else moved behind it or in front of it that would, cause any doubt? And then the robot basically says back to the operator, okay, this is the target I'm locked onto. Is this the one that you want to fire at? And the operator then hits the commit button, yes, fire. And the robot, quarter second later goes, okay, do I still have an absolute guaranteed, yes, that's it. I know, I've been tracking it successfully. Nothing else has intervened in front or behind that might, hit an innocent, target, innocent civilian. So I have a clear shot and I'm going to fire. That's the sort of check, recheck process that we're trying to implement now for how to handle things like latency.
Right. Wow. So that's the boring reality. The real hurdles that you have to get over.
Yes, it's not Terminator pointing its weapon and going bang bang bang. Yeah. That warrior spirit, and what's different, you know, when I was young and I was playing the very early interactive games, you know, the stuff that even came before D&D was mostly military sims.
Right, war games, yeah.
Right. And, you know, we'd do these intricate sort of terrain models on large format sort of boards. And I had won this one engagement, totally blew through the opposing thing, but I had done it by sacrificing a scout unit and drawing the enemy fire. And, you know, it made lots. I lost less of the soldiers in my unit than I would have if I had, you know, tried to be more protective. But I had a hard time sleeping that night. I really did. I was, you know, the 20 guys in that, you know, scout tank unit, it was real for me. I mean, I remember to this day, because it was 40 years ago, thinking, you know, it could have been a future Nobel Prize winner. It could have been a serial rapist. It was the arbitrariness of you unit, go out there, go over that ridgeline and get yourself shot all to kingdom come. Because it's going to let me see where the bad guys are and then drop artillery on them. And it worked, but it just terrified me. I don't ever want to be in that place where I'm having to make that call for real. One of the things I run into, especially with the maker community, because I love making things.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of pushback about, you know, why are you building these robots that are going to kill humanity? And yet they love making prop weapons and stuff like that. I'm going, okay, guys, you know, and there's, especially out in the West Coast, there's a real distrust of anything to do with the military. And yeah, I get it. I realized early on that I did not want to ever be in the military. Taking a life that I'm not a warrior in that sense. I mean, push came to shove, I'm sure I would do what I needed to do, but it's not a thing that I seek out. But that's very different from the people who think of it as somehow being evil. And I say to them, look, you know, United States, we're this very small fraction of the total world population. We take up a lot more resources out of the world than is proportionate. I mean, we live this insanely rich lifestyle compared to the rest of the world. And that pisses off a lot of people in other countries who would like to take some of what we have. Some of them don't have a much ethical problem about, you know, doing that by force. You know, unless you're willing to give that up and live a much poorer lifestyle, you know, at the end of the day, we need somebody who's willing to go out there and apply force. I mean, we have checks and balances. We hopefully have civilian leadership that's responsible. We don't just, you know, blaze away at stuff. But you know, we need the military as that backstop to preserve the life that we all take for granted. And we have a very small military. We want that military to be as scary as possible so we don't have to use it.
Right. <You know>? Yeah.
And so, you know, we create these systems to make them that much more effective and also to protect them. So like right now, 90% plus of U.S. military power is actually within the United States itself. If something happens in the world, we're getting on an airplane to go there.
Right, you're not already there.
Right, and the densest combat power is a soldier. You know, without all the tanks and the big heavy machines. I mean, you can fit a rifle company on a C-17, a transport aircraft, and get that rifle company anywhere in the world inside of 24 hours. An infantry brigade is essentially, nine rifle companies. You think, oh, nine C-17s. Well, you got to bring along some other stuff. But it turns out that there's about 3,500 soldiers and 1,000 vehicles in an infantry brigade. If you bring the whole thing along, that's about 150 C-17s in 4 days, But with the robots that we're building, we can get them in the same C-17 as the rifle company. You get a dozen C-17s there. You get 80% of the combat power. And the thing that the robots give those soldiers is right now they're wearing right on their body about 30 kilos, about 65 pounds of stuff, body armor, their weapon, their helmet. And then their rucksack, they're putting on another 30 kilos plus. I mean, they're carrying around 60 kilos, 130 pounds of gear, and then the standard for a forced march is going 20 kilometers, 12 miles in 3 hours. that's just short of a jog.
Yep.
By the time that they get there, they're going to be dead tired. Because when a C-17 it can't land right on the target, it's going to land offset, and then the soldiers are going to march in. As things stand right now, no, they're not moving. They're going to stay in the landing zone until they build out and get more supplies and get vehicles in. With the robots that we're building, it'll carry their gear. It'll carry the supplies. It'll go 72 hours. It'll go 100 kilometers. And it'll bring along heavier weapons so that if they run into a more mechanized force, they have a chance to fight back. It gives them the ability to do the mission, do it more quickly, and for more of the soldiers to survive. And these are guys I work with. I mean, I knew EOD soldiers who didn't come back. I know guys who got shot. I want to make our military effective, and I also want to, do something to help protect the guys that I work with.
Absolutely. And that is, I don't think anybody could argue that that is not a very noble endeavor. So,
well, lots of people could argue that. What was it? I was afraid I was being boring.
Not at all. No, you forget. I sympathize because I feel that way sometimes. I'm as I think you might know, I'm a writer.
Yes,
I write fiction, and the process of writing fiction to me is so dull and boring that I have the same sort of thing. Like I forget sometimes that people who don't do it find how I put words on the page, they find that fascinating. To me, that's the most boring thing I could possibly talk about. But it took me a long time to realize, oh no, other people actually find this really interesting. And I'm sure you're in the same boat. So,
right. By the time you get to the second rewrite of a very long piece, you're like, I just,
right.
Wanna, yeah.